Today on New Horizons in Education, John Bradford, Director of the Center for Geophysical Investigation of the Shallow Subsurface at Boise State.
We know that as climate warms, permafrost is going to melt. The melt will be more extensive, so the thaw depth will be greater every year, and the amount of region that's thawed is going to increase substantially. Graduate students were asked to assist the Sheriff's Department in locating a shallow buried grave, and they took the radar out and actually were successful in locating that. The large ice sheets, say Greenland and Antarctica, as they're starting to warm up, we can understand that better by studying these smaller glaciers.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons in Education. John Bradford is director of the Center for Geophysical Investigation of the Shallow Subsurface at Boise State and an assistant professor in the Department of Geosciences. Since its inception in 1991, CGIS, that's the acronym for the Center for Geophysical Investigation of the Shallow Subsurface, has received more than $12 million in external research funding. CGIS is the largest geophysics research group in the nation that is focused exclusively on the Earth's shallow subsurface and one of the largest groups globally. Dr. Bradford studies glaciers in remote corners of Alaska. He and other Boise State scientists also conduct research studies on Alaska's North Slope to document the effects of increasing thawing of permafrost beneath stream beds. In addition, Dr. Bradford has worked in Norway on research to develop better ways to locate oil spills trapped beneath sea ice. He earned a Ph.D. in geophysics from Rice University in 1999. That same year, he was named one of Houston's best and brightest by Technology Houston magazine. John Bradford, welcome to New Horizons in Education.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, let's begin with the basics as far as your education is concerned. You actually studied as a physicist, as I understand it, and found your way into geophysics. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. I started out, I did my undergraduate degree in physics and chemical engineering, and I didn't really know anything about geophysics. And in my senior year, I learned something about it. I realized that I didn't want to be just stuck in a lab in a basement somewhere, and thought this was a great way to bring my love of physics and mathematics to the outside world.
So for those of us who still don't appreciate the significance of geophysics or the definition of geophysics, help us distinguish between physics and geophysics as it applies to your career today.
So geophysics really is just a sub-discipline of physics where we're using the principles and mathematics of physics to understand and study the Earth and the Earth's subsurface. So at the Center for Geophysical Investigation of the Shallow Subsurface, we are defining shallow, meaning the upper few hundred feet of the Earth's surface, maybe down to 1,000 feet or so below the surface. And we use tools such as ground-penetrating radar to investigate the layers of material that are in the surface. We investigate rocks that are in the subsurface. We investigate the fluids that are contained in those materials and how they move through the subsurface.
And what techniques do you use to do that investigation?
Well, so I mentioned ground-penetrating radar, which is the same technology that's used to, say, identify planes in the air. We just direct it in the other direction and send radio waves into the ground. We also use elastic waves or sound waves where we shake the surface of the Earth and then record the sound waves that return back. And we also use electromagnetic methods where we generate currents at the surface of the Earth and send those electrical currents through the ground and measure how the ground alters those currents.
Mm-hmm. Now, your center has a number of faculty and graduate students working. You're funded, obviously, by a variety of grants, I would assume.
Yes, that's correct. So we have grants from the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency. We also do some private contracts with local companies and national companies mm-hmm. as well.
And you're collaborating with other universities in some of these grants?
Oh, certainly. We have collaborators all over the world. We have collaborators from many major universities in the United States, universities in Europe, universities mm-hmm. in South America and Africa as well.
Mm-hmm. When you prepare a student here at Boise State for a master's degree or a doctorate in geophysics, where are they going to head? Where are their careers going to take them?
some of our students end up going into the oil industry, and even though that's not the sort of training we provide, certainly the methods that they learn while they're here are directly applicable to the oil industry. But we've also placed students with the Department of Energy, and our PhD students now, our doctoral students, are starting to go into more academic careers, which mm-hmm. is ultimately what we would hope that they would do mm-hmm. and become leaders, you know, themselves in academia.
Right. Now, when it comes to the research projects, the one that caught my eye was the role that contaminants play underground and how you record those and how you measure those. Give us a couple of examples of real life situations where a geophysicist is called in or your center goes to work trying to figure something out that relates to a spill or a contaminant getting on the loose.
Sure. One example, and this is a fairly typical example, I would say, was at Hill Air Force Base in Utah. And there were a number of contaminants released on the base, and people didn't necessarily know how much or that this stuff was there. But eventually, these contaminants made their way into people's water wells. And that's where it started to create a problem. Hydrologists might come in and trace the contaminants back to their source. But in this process where we're trying to learn where the contaminants came from, that's where geophysics would become involved. And for example, when contaminants are introduced into the ground, they have different properties, like different electrical properties or different elastic properties. And when they displace water in the subsurface, that creates a signal that we can measure. That creates an anomaly and properties that we can measure with geophysical tools. Mm-hmm. And that allows us to map the contaminants and maybe track where they've come from, but also, you know, predict where they might go in the mm-hmm. future. So.
Now, in some cases, can I assume that the nature of the substance will determine how much of the bad stuff, if we can call it that, is trapped in the subsurface and how much actually gets to, say, the water supply in a well situation, for example?
That's certainly true. So one of the contaminants that I look at, I'll use a long term here, but it's a non-aqueous phase liquids, which probably doesn't mean a lot to folks, but it's stuff that's not doesn't dissolve in water. So it tends to, in relatively small concentrations, get out into the water, and that very small dissolved component is the part that people might find in their well. But there's a big source area, right, and that delivers contaminants into the groundwater system for many, many years. So if you can find the source area and get that stuff out, you can prevent contamination for many years to come. Mm-hmm. So that's the real objective for that particular problem. Mm-hmm. And an example of that is dry cleaning fluid. People don't realize, but many, many old dry cleaning facilities are now Superfund sites.
Well, I realize it only all too well because there was a dry cleaning site on the edge of the Boise State University campus, and you may know this, but it's leaking across the campus as we speak, and we're trying to figure out how to assess liability and get it cleaned up, so we may need your center to go work on that one.
Well, you may be happy to know that we're already considering that. And
oh, good.
With some collaborators across
good.
Campus are trying to write a proposal to build that as a local field laboratory. To study methods to characterize that material.
Well, that's good to hear. It's a story that really isn't a subject for this show, but it's one of those unfortunate things that you find visited upon you every now and then. Now, let's talk about your graduate and doctoral students. How do they fit into this picture of what you're doing, and what specific kinds of projects are they involved with?
Well, our students are really involved in every project that we do, and they're really a key component in getting the work done. The students, not only are they going to classes while they're here, our graduate students, but they're also, you know, doing a lot of the real nuts and bolts of getting the research done. So mm-hmm. Every year we do a lot of field work, and the students come out with us, help us acquire data. In many cases, they're helping us, particularly the doctoral students, are helping us design the surveys and better understand the science that goes into this. Mm-hmm. And they're also helping write the papers and doing the cutting-edge research that we eventually hope to publish, and which also helps us continue getting additional grant funding.
Mm-hmm. Again, you're listening to John Bradford. He is the director of the Center for Geophysical Investigation of the Shallow Subsurface. Well, there's one particular assignment that your students had with some of your faculty, I suppose, that might find its way on CSI. A criminal science investigation or whatever. You did something over in Gooding, I understand, that was a little out of your normal range of assignments.
That's true. This is what you're referring to is something that falls into the category. It's another subdiscipline of geophysics that's called forensic geophysics, where you use geophysical tools to try and help solve crimes. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case that you're referring to, a couple of our graduate students were asked to use ground penetrating radar again, which is a tool that was also featured on CSI in an episode a couple of years ago. These graduate students were asked to assist the sheriff's department in locating a shallow buried grave, and they took the radar out and actually were successful in locating that. What wasn't publicized is that we were involved in a similar situation this summer, where I received a call from the Boise Police Department, and we went and assisted them in locating a shallow grave here in town. Just a similar scenario. It's a situation that is not entirely comfortable, but a place that we can help assist the community and put our skills to use in a way that we don't normally. Mm-hmm. But forensic geophysics is actually a large area of research, but one that we're not focused directly on in our center.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it about the definition of 300 feet of shallow subsurface or 1,000 feet of subsurface? Is this a scientific standard, or is this a standard your center uses because this makes sense here in the Boise region? If you were doing the same thing on the East Coast, would you still be looking at 300 feet to 1,000 feet, or does it vary, or is that just the, as I said, the gold standard for geophysicists?
Well, it's not a really clear definition, but it's sort of the definition that geophysicists use to make the separation between traditional geophysics, which is looking at much greater depths, several thousand feet into the subsurface, or even more at, say, the core of the Earth or the deep interior of the Earth. It's a definition that we've sort of accepted, and it varies to some extent. It's really an important area, though, because this is the zone of the Earth that humans interact most closely with. So in terms of getting our water from the ground, this is where it comes from. In terms of, you know, potentially polluting that water, this is also where we are influencing the Earth. So that makes it particularly important. It's really important to differentiate this shallow part because there are a number of complications and problems associated with studying that part of the Earth with geophysics that differentiates it from conventional or traditional geophysics. Mm-hmm.
Now, we have a unique field research station here just east of town, as I understand it. And what makes that unique or relatively unique?
So the field laboratory that we have that's just east of town, it's a controlled well field. And there are about three or four of these around the country. Our site, which was really founded by Warren Barish in 1996, he started it and is continuing to operate it now. But all of the CGIS researchers are involved at the site. This site is really unique. One, it's a nice place to work because it's in Boise, so we like that. But it's unique in the sense that it has complicated sediments in the subsurface. So it's got a mixture of boulders and cobbles and sand, which makes it very different from the other sites around the country. And this uniqueness really has attracted researchers from all over the country and all over the world that are very interested in coming and using our facilities here. This past summer, for example, we had a joint experiment that involved researchers from Italy, France, Taiwan, and Canada. And in addition to that, these researchers brought their students, and we conducted a short course in another subdiscipline, which is called hydrogeophysics, for these students. So there was both scientific research and education with these students and researchers from all over the world, and it went off very successfully.
You know, John, I spend most of my time trying to explain to people here in Idaho, especially state legislators and other public officials, what role research plays in the local economy and why it's important for the so-called pure research that we do to be funded both by government and, of course, by agencies such as NSF and what have you. This is a perfect example. I mean, these people are coming in from around the world. They have to have a place to stay. They eat in town. They recreate. They're entertained. And it's all driven into the local economy.
That's true. And another point in that is they're coming here and hopefully seeing what a great place Boise State is and Boise is and taking that and sort of spreading the word when they go back to their home institutions.
Exactly. Now, you're really a globetrotter. I mean, the fact of the matter is you don't just spend all your time here in Boise. You were telling me before the show that about 2 months a year over the last 6 or 7 years, you've really been on the road. And by on the road, I don't mean going to the other side of the United States. You're traveling internationally. You're in on Alaskan glaciers. You're in Norway. Let's start, if we could, by talking about your field studies on the Alaskan glacier. This is a project funded by the National Science Foundation. And again, just to help us all understand how these dollars, you mentioned earlier, your center is funded by research grants from a variety of agencies, including the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy. Let's go back to the beginning. John Bradford and his colleagues at the center get an idea for a project, and they'd like to present it to NSF. Give us some idea of how long it's going to take from the moment you sit down with the application in front of you until you get the money, how many people are involved, whether you do this on a solo mission with Boise State or whether you go out and find collaborators. Help us understand how the research project comes to fruition.
Well, of course, it varies a lot, and the amount of time that it takes to get the funding and how many people are involved can vary substantially. But in all of my research, I actually have a number of collaborators, mostly from other universities around the country or internationally. And we sit down maybe with an idea. We write up the proposal. And one thing that a lot of folks don't understand is that getting funding from National Science Foundation or the other national funding agencies is extremely competitive. Most funding agencies now are at less than, say, 10% of the applications that are submitted actually get funding. So oftentimes you don't get funded on your first try. And it takes a lot of time to put these proposals together. But we'll put a proposal together, submit it. Sometimes it's not accepted the first time. So one thing that I've learned that's very important is to persevere. So you may get good reviews or good feedback from the agency. And you incorporate that information in and resubmit it. And this turnaround process is anywhere from 6 months to a year. So then let's say you are awarded a grant. You're awarded a grant, and it's usually 6 to 9 months before you actually get the money and the research actually starts. But then once that happens, the grants normally last anywhere from 2 to 3 years. In the projects that I'm involved with, I normally have 2 to 3 or maybe up to 5 collaborators. Sometimes that includes researchers from Boise State. Sometimes it only includes researchers from other universities. But there's a big mix. And we always try to fund students. So another thing that folks might not recognize is that the funding that we're getting from National Science Foundation and other agencies is also used to provide funding for our graduate students in particular, but we also pay undergraduate students. So in almost all of the projects that I do, I involve a number of undergraduate students that are enrolled in the programs at Boise State, and this gives them an opportunity to see both real-world research and to get a better understanding of what they might be involved with if they choose to go into geophysics in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard from some of our faculty in the sciences that what's different about Boise State University's undergraduate experience is the fact that at larger research universities, the undergraduates get shoved to the side and the graduate students get these opportunities you're talking about. Is that the same way in geophysics when it comes to giving undergraduates opportunities that maybe they wouldn't get at a larger research university?
I think that's a good point, and that's also a big advantage that we have in CGIS. We're such an active research group, and there's so much field work going on all the time that there's lots of opportunities. So there's plenty of work for the undergraduates to do as well as work for our graduate students.
You know, we were talking about applying for the project. When you talk about an application, we're not talking about a 3-page application you might have to fill out to get a bank loan. This is a slightly larger tome, you might call it.
Sure. The applications that we submit are anywhere from 15 to 30 pages, and that's just one component of it. And we have to submit resumes, and we have to submit evidence of prior publications, and there's a good deal of work that goes into putting these together, and they all have to be done very well and very precisely to compete at all. For example, the glacier project that you're mentioning, that was one of only 3 glaciology projects that were funded in the year that it was funded, and it's the only glaciology project that's been funded over the last 3 years to study small mountain glaciers. And that doesn't mean that that's only one that was submitted. This is out of dozens of proposals that get submitted to study these sorts of things.
You're listening to John Bradford. He is director of the Center for the Geophysical Investigation of the Shallow Subsurface here at Boise State University. We're learning a lot about geophysics today and geoscience. Well, let's go ahead and talk about that. The Bench Glacier, was that the name of the project?
Yes, the Bench Glacier Project. This is a project that we initiated to try and better understand how water flows and is stored in glaciers. And a lot of people might not recognize that water. There is a lot of water that's flowing through and being stored in glaciers. The glaciers in southeast Alaska are all temperate glaciers, and that means that the glaciers are very close to the melting point. Because of this, they have a lot of water in the glacier on the surface and within the glacier itself. And this water gets both routed through the glacier, through fractures and void spaces. And then when it's routed through the glacier, it flows at the bed of the glacier, which sort of lubricates the bed of the glacier and makes the glacier flow faster. These two things combined make a big impact in how fast the glacier flows and how fast it might be ablated or disappear. Now, the Bench Glacier itself is a small glacier and overall doesn't have a great deal of importance. But it's small enough, it's a small enough scale that we can use it as sort of a field laboratory to better understand these processes.
What's small for you?
Small. So the glacier itself is about 4 miles long, and it's about 600 feet thick at its thickest point. Okay. And it's about a mile wide, something like that.
And there's no interstate highway to get you to it?
No interstate highway. In fact, there's a big river between us and the closest road, which means that we have to helicopter in and helicopter all of our equipment in every year. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting operation in itself. But the importance of this is that the large ice sheets, say Greenland and Antarctica, as they're starting to warm up, the same processes are going to be occurring in those big ice sheets. And those processes still are not particularly well understood, but will have a big impact on how fast the ice sheets disappear, which could lead to increased sea level rise, and how they respond to a warming climate. So we can understand that better by studying these smaller glaciers. Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the window for your getting there and staying there? Time of the year?
Oh, well, we could go anytime. And in fact, we have a plan to do a winter study on the Bench Glacier in particular. But normally we work from, say, late May until late August. That's about the time that we have to work on the glacier. And that's in part because it's logistically easier. You know, if you're working in the summertime as opposed to the winter, it's much easier to try and get your work done. But that's also where most of the water flow is occurring, so that's when we're most interested in studying the glacier.
Mm-hmm. Are you living in tents during that period? Or
that's right. We live in tents. We have all of our food and supplies are all helicoptered in, and we build, you know, a small camp that we live in for anywhere from 2 weeks to a month or so. And in the past, some of the glaciologists I work with have lived on the glacier for 2 or 3 months at a time. So,
well, talk about the research conclusions from this study.
Well, so it's still an ongoing study, of course, but we've learned several things, and some of the things that we've learned are really leading to a new model or new understanding of water storage in glaciers. The old conceptual model was that water was simply routed through sort of conduit or pipe-like structures from the surface to the bed. And what we found is that, in fact, the interior of the glacier is filled with many, many fractures, and these fractures are connected to each other in very complicated ways. But what it means is that a lot more water can be stored and routed through the glacier than was previously thought. And this has really come about in large part because of our research, but there are also other researchers around the globe that are working on the same problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also done another research project in Alaska on the Brooks Range, and there you're measuring the thaw depth beneath Arctic streams. Again, help us understand why that's important.
So by the thaw depth, let's first just define what permafrost is. So permafrost is frozen ground, and on the north slope of Alaska, the frozen soil or frozen ground extends to almost 2,000 feet below the subsurface. And it's frozen all the way to the surface in the wintertime, and then when summer comes, it melts a little bit, and you get a zone of thaw that extends from the surface to just 2 or 3 feet below the surface. In the streams, because there's water flowing there, you tend to get more thaw. So there's a zone that we call the thaw bulb beneath the stream. But this zone creates an area where surface water, the water in the streams, can interact with the groundwater. And this is where nutrients are exchanged. And this is very important for ecosystem processes. So what we've been doing is using, again, this tool called ground penetrating radar to try and image the zone of thaw beneath the streams so we could better understand how the surface water might be interacting with the subsurface and how nutrients are being delivered to the ecosystem. The reason that we're looking at this problem is we know that as climate warms, the interaction with the permafrost is going to change. Permafrost is going to melt. The melt will be more extensive, so the thaw depth will be greater every year. And the amount of region that's thawed is going to increase substantially as the climate warms. So we're trying to, in some sense, get a little bit ahead of the game so that we might predict what changes the ecosystem is going to see because of this increased warming.
Now, that sounds like a project where you would have collaborators from related sciences.
That's correct. So one collaborator is Jim McNamara. He's a hydrologist in the Department of Geosciences here. We have collaborators also at Penn State University and the University of Vermont. One is a hydrologist and another is an ecologist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we may have time for one more example of your work. And now we're going to go all the way to Norway. And we're going to talk about the research that you've done to detect oil under sea ice.
Sure. So in areas, in Arctic regions where there's oil production, there's always the potential for oil spills. And if these oil spills occur offshore, say from a pipeline that's laid at the seabed, the oil tends to leak out, say, from the pipeline. Since it's lighter than water, it floats up through the water column. But then since there's a layer of sea ice, the oil gets trapped at the interface between the water and the sea ice. Now, currently, there's no real efficient way for detecting that oil. So folks are just going out with augers and randomly looking for oil if there happens to be a spill. Ground penetrating radar, again, is a tool that we can use to see through the ice and identify where the oil is, which can make the cleanup operations more rapid and more efficient and more inexpensive overall. So it's quite an important problem. And we've been working on this project since 2003 now. Two years ago, we did an experiment in Norway where we did a controlled spill of oil and worked on one of the sea ice covered fjords in Svalbard, which is an island that's actually offshore the north coast of Norway. Mm-hmm. And we're successful in demonstrating our technologies, and we're continuing to work on that project, and we'll likely be participating in a large controlled spill that's offshore in the Norwegian Sea in the next 2 years.
Who funds a project like that?
This particular project is funded by the Mineral Management Services, which is a division of the Bureau of Interior. And we also have funding from the Alaska Department of Conservation. And we have funding from Alaska Clean Seas, which is a consortium of oil companies that does all the cleanup in Prudhoe Bay on the coast of the Arctic Ocean on the north side of Alaska.
I guess that's what I was thinking of, is it seems to me, since we're talking about oil spills here, that the oil industry ought to be ponying up some of the funding kinds of research.
Yeah, they certainly are. So through Alaska Clean Seas, and there's also, we get direct funding from Statoil, which is a Norwegian oil company. Shell International has provided funding for some of this work. Mm-hmm. So they certainly are interested in developing new methods for helping with the cleanup problem.
Now, we're going to go to the legislature with a request this year for funding that will be the final piece of funding for the new building on our campus that will house geosciences. And I understand you and your center will be a part of that new facility.
Yes, and I have to say we're really looking forward to that. Our program has been growing rapidly, as you know, over the last few years. And we have the graduate student population has been increasing rapidly, and we're really just bursting at the seams. So we're really looking forward to this new building, which will house graduate students and allow us to expand or really just make up, what we've sort of been missing, I guess, for a while now, and then expand into the future. And, you know, this really is what will make our jobs, you know, much easier. So we're really looking forward to that facility coming around.
Well, we expect to rely on the support of our friends in the community when it comes to letting the legislature know the importance of this project and the role that research plays in the life of Boise State University and its students. And, John, you've done a great job today of helping us understand how that role of research at Boise State is related not only to places across the globe, but right here back at home in the local economy. We thank you for what you've done at the center, and thanks for being on New Horizons in Education.
Well, thank you. I certainly appreciate the opportunity.
Great. Next week, Forest Service entomologist Barbara Bentz talking about the western bark beetle and how climate change is affecting its habitat and population in western forests. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons in Education.